shake them off, Doc. Everybody, you're gonna take them again. You are your foe, your friend. You are the paparazzi. You are the tragedy end.
Welcome back to the program, and we might as well be walking on the sun. It's getting pretty hot in the southwestern U.S., and according to the latest IPCC report, we're going to see more droughts, permanent droughts, they're calling it, because of the effects of climate change. Who better than to comment on this than Ross Gelbspan, who's made this his career, writing about it, speaking about it. Before we went to break, we were just getting to the, you know, some of the problems that they're predicting are going to be with us. And what's your sense of how soon in terms of droughts, wildfires? We heard a lot about rising sea levels in the first report. This one seems to be sort of the hellish aspects of climate change.
Well, that's true. And one of the things that the scientists don't know is how fast this is going to happen. I mean, there is a little bit of a lack of candor in terms of scientific ignorance. Again, because, as I said before, this stuff is happening so much more quickly than the scientists had anticipated. But in terms of drought, for example, they are anticipating much more severe drought in the whole southwestern part of the U.S., and all you need to do is look at Australia. New South Wales, which is the breadbasket of Australia, has been locked in what seems to be now a permanent drought for the last 7 or 8 years, and agricultural yields have fallen dramatically. And that's not just because of extreme weather. It's because of some more fundamental changes that are taking place in the planet. So real briefly, just to talk about that drought, there are winds that swirl around the two poles. And as the atmosphere warms, it actually accelerates, it intensifies and tightens the vortex of these polar winds. So what's happening in southern Australia is that the water that used to evaporate up out of the southern ocean and rain down in the agricultural areas, these winds have tightened, and so as that water evaporates up, it's being drawn back into Antarctica. And it's actually building up glaciers in the interior of Antarctica, and at the same time, it has created what is entering its eighth year as a really severe drought in Australia. So these are changes that are even sort of above and beyond the normal extreme weather events that we're used to. And those are the kinds of things that the scientists are very, very frightened about. And they cannot predict with any kind of accuracy the timing of these impacts.
One thing we do know is that the poor are already and will continue to suffer disproportionately.
Absolutely. And that's a major emphasis of this report. And it was also what Rajendra Pachauri, the head of the IPCC, spoke to when he was talking about the fact that the impacts of climate change disproportionately hit the world's poorest countries and the poorest people in the world's wealthiest countries. And that is very important to understand. And it's not because nature discriminates against the poor. It's because poor countries really can't afford the kind of infrastructures to buffer these impacts that the wealthy countries can. That said, in the really long term, it may be that really poor people in really poor countries are better off than people like you and me. Because if we hit a period of runaway climate change and things really take off in a way that scientists are terrified of them taking off, it's really people who are used to living close to the earth and close to the bone
and simply,
who are better prepared to survive than people like you and me who depend on our technologically insulated lives these days.
Interesting.
But that's sort of a long view.
And that's a silver lining in a small bit of good news in the otherwise bad news landscape. We would just have a little less than 2 minutes left. I want to ask you Ross Gelbspan's prescription for guerrilla climate change rectification.
Well, it's not so much guerrilla because I've gotten great responses from other governments everywhere but in the U.S., but basically there are three simple strategies that are very large and very doable, the main one of which is to change energy subsidies. Right now, last year, the U.S. government spent about $35 billion subsidizing oil and coal. The industrial world spent about $200 billion. We're saying take that money away from fossil fuels, put them behind renewables, and a number of things will happen. First of all, the oil companies will follow the money, and they'll become aggressive developers of solar power and wind and tidal power and so forth. And I think those subsidy shifts would also bring out of the woodwork an army of energy engineers and entrepreneurs with a lot of clean energy devices and a kind of explosion of creativity that would rival the dot-com revolution of the
90s. We're seeing that in Silicon Valley now. There's a rush to want to help.
Well, that's right, exactly, and we need a framework for that. So we need that. We also need a large fund to transfer these technologies to developing countries. just about all poor countries would love to go solar. They have the most air-polluted cities in the world. There is no resistance to this in China and India and Mexico and Nigeria. They just can't afford it. And so we need a large fund. It's been calculated at about $300 billion for about a decade to set up clean energy infrastructures in developing countries. And then the third mechanism that really comes from a former utility company president is that would make this all work is a regulatory mechanism in the Kyoto framework, a progressive fossil fuel efficiency standard, whereby every country would increase its fossil fuel efficiency by 5% a year. And that means they generate the same amount of goods and commerce next year with 5% less carbon fuel, or they'd produce 5% more with the same amount of carbon fuel. And since no economy grows for very long at 5%, emissions reductions would outpace long-term economic growth.
Ross, I'm afraid we're out of time, but if people want to read more about your brilliant plan, read Boiling Point, How Politicians, Big Oil, and Coal, Journalists, and Activists Are Fueling the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do to Avert Disaster. Ross, thanks so much. When we come back, photographer Chris Jordan will show us up close what consumption looks like, captivating art depicting a consumption-crazed lifestyle, right after these messages.